Going to open the hearing on House Bill 3677. Representative Williams and Greg Mile, please.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. For the record, I am Representative Max Williams. I represent House District 9 in the legislature. And it's my pleasure to be here this morning briefly on a bill which I sponsored along with a number of co-sponsors, House Bill 3677. I'll start with just a little bit of background on this bill. There was another bill introduced last session that also was the beginning of a conversation about addressing an issue that I frankly have some concern about as it affects the ability and the long-term functionality of legislative proposals and their interpretation by the court in court cases. The discussion revolves around a case known as PGE versus Boley. I don't know if this is true. Some have said it's the most cited case currently in Oregon opinions. It's certainly a frequently cited case. Whether it holds the distinction of being the most cited case, I don't know. But essentially what PGE versus Boley said was that when the court interprets legislative, or when the court looks at statute, they look first at the text and context of the words. And only if in doing so they determine that that is unambiguous, or that that is ambiguous, that do they then turn to legislative history. As many of you know, in our committees, we often joke as people are wanting to put things on the record, or as people are attempting to make legislative history, we regularly kid among ourselves as legislators that, you know, someday if the court ever does happen to see this, maybe they'll recognize what it was we were talking about, but the likelihood is rather small under PGE versus Boley because they first start with a text and context analysis. Now, I don't disagree with the general thought that you ought to go first to text and context, but I also believe that you at times would have a difficult time understanding whether or not there was ambiguity in the statute if you didn't understand the context in which the statute moved through the legislative process. And so this is really an effort to begin a discussion about how to make the import of legislative history more effective. There have been a number of cases in the last several years where I think you could argue that PGE versus Boley has resulted in an outcome which was different than the legislature intended. Not every one of those I would defend the legislature on. Clearly, in some circumstances, we have a duty and an obligation to be more clear in what it is we intend and to be more careful. On the other hand, I think it has led in some situations to results which, frankly, had the legislative history been consulted, would have been different, and different in a way that would have been more likely beneficial to the participants or to the state interest that was being attempted to address by the legislature. House Bill 3677 is not a bill that I necessarily wrote with respect to the language, and as a result, I don't have a great pride of authorship. Mine was a concept. Other people attempted to craft the language. I am here to say today to you that while I believe that this does need to be addressed, I'm not married to the format in which it's addressed in this particular bill. But I believe, and there is even some argument, and I think it's only fair that I put this on the record, that anything the legislature does with respect to ORS 174 is an invitation for the court to reconsider the position of PGE versus Boley. But there is an argument about whether constitutionally we can even direct the court as to what they must consider in getting to their opinion. That's a constitutional argument which I am willing to concede exists. But I think as representatives of the legislature, we have an obligation to do our utmost to try to ensure that our legislative intent on a piece of statute, law, bill, referral gets appropriately analyzed by the court. And if we can do so by inviting the court to do that with revisions to Chapter 174, then I think it's worthy of our discussion and our consideration. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to defer questions until Mr. Mao has had a chance to speak for the procedure and practice section of the bar, and then I think we'd both be willing to take questions.
Thank you, Representative Williams. Mr. Mao.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might clarify at the first that while I am an attorney practicing in Portland, I am here today on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Public Affairs Committee. The individual sections have not had an opportunity to review the draft proposed language, which was put together by a bar work group, and I wouldn't want to suggest endorsement of a particular section. The Public Affairs Committee of the State Bar does support alternative language, which has been submitted with my testimony as an amendment to the bill. Various groups within the Oregon State Bar have expressed concern over the current form of House Bill 3677, in addition to the potential constitutional issue which Representative Williams raised. In response to those concerns, the Public Affairs Committee formed a work group of individual members from various bar sections and committees. That work group operated under the understanding that the intent of the legislative proposal was to allow a court to determine and consider what information would be appropriate in construing legislative intent and give such weight as appropriate to include information on text, context, and legislative or specific initiative history of the statute. I won't read the text of the proposed revision, but I would just highlight a couple of points to underscore what we were intending to do here. We have, to some degree, shortened Section 1 of the bill. We have eliminated use of two terms, purpose and meaning, on the assumption that by interplay of three different words, intent, purpose, and meaning, there was a potential for confusion as opposed to clarity. So we have focused solely on the issue of intent. We have tried to add some a little more limitation in terms of the legislative history that would be required to be considered by eliminating the notion of public statements outside of the legislative record-making context because it was unclear as to how far that might go and whether it would include speeches to the Rotary and so forth. So we have proposed to limit the legislative history to the actual proceedings. The other, I guess, main thing we did was to try to avoid creating a situation where legislative history would have to be examined in every case, even when it was not really an issue. And there are different ways you could address that. The way that we chose to do it was in subsection 2 of our proposed rewrite to section 1. Which would require a court to initially consider the legislative history only to the extent that the parties made it available. And the assumption would be that if there were no genuine dispute as to legislative history, neither party would feel an obligation to do that. Justice Gillette has pointed out to me probably an overstatement in subsection 2, in that we indicated that the court would be required to consider information in subsection C and D only when the parties made that information available. Probably that should be limited to subsection D because subsection C is actually dealing with other statutes and I think would be more properly part of the text and context of the statute rather than legislative history. So. With that slight amendment, we would propose that the HB 3677 be amended with respect to Section 1. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Questions of this panel? Representative Ringo.
Thank you. There's a Court of Appeals judge, I don't remember the name, who issued an opinion doing so with a primordial scream. Because that judge felt compelled to issue a ruling that was completely contradictory to any logic. And I don't know if you're aware. Are you aware of that decision?
I'm not sure which one.
Okay. Well, he issued an opinion that said, you know, I've got to follow the letter of the law, PGE versus Bowley, even though this doesn't make any sense. And the reason was because of PGE versus Bowley, and it was unambiguous the way it was written. And I'm wondering, both 3677 as written and your proposed amendments have included in it, without regard to whether the statute is ambiguous. And I'm wondering if, under your proposed fix, if the court is examining a statute that is unambiguous, but nevertheless seems to be contradictory to the statutory scheme, to the legislative intent, to other case law, whether the court can rule against what is unambiguous language.
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, you have effectively zeroed in on, I think, what is perhaps the most challenging part of this discussion as we attempt to address PGE versus Bowley, which is, I don't think any of us are interested, I don't think the court's interested, and I don't think any of us in the legislature are frankly interested in a scheme which would allow the court sort of on its own to say, even though it says white, we think you meant black. We want to avoid that situation, and I want to make sure that whatever we do doesn't essentially worsen the current situation with that sort of an approach. At the same time, the idea, I think, of creating a standard by which legislative history would be elevated, not above text and context, but elevated to a level of consideration regardless of ambiguity, was to allow for a determination based on a review of legislative history in the context in which it was passed, whether or not there was some ambiguity that wouldn't have been absolutely apparent in the text and context analysis.
So there would be ambiguity when you would go to the second layer.
I think you would look at the legislative history and then make a determination. I argue at times that you can't tell something is potentially ambiguous unless you understand the context in which the legislature addressed or attempted to address this issue. And if you never get there because you're using, you know, Webster's dictionary is the way to define this word, that creates an opportunity for you to just sort of gloss over what may have been the actual context in which the legislation was passed or in which the statute became law. And I think it simply warrants that it have some equal footing as opposed to being sort of relegated to a level below text and context only if it's ambiguous. You never get there. So I think there's got to be a way, and maybe this isn't the cleanest way, but there's got to be a way that you allow for that. And I like and view the bar's recommended amendment, to the extent the parties make it available, sort of an approach as a good triggering event. I don't think necessarily the court on its own motion has to go out and dig up the legislative history. If the parties themselves aren't willing to dig into it to make that determination, you're stuck with what the words say. But if a party is aware and comes forward with appropriate legislative history that would show or strengthen their position with respect to an interpretation by the statute, I think at that point it warrants consideration in the entire scheme of interpreting legislative intent, which is what the court is attempting to do in the first place.
Mayor Shetterly.
Isn't the savings clause, and maybe the clause that may ultimately prove to make this ineffective to change anything, and we know the risk of that, in subsection 3 under 1, both in the original bill and in Greg's version where it says the court will consider these and give weight to the information that the court considers appropriate. Doesn't that effectively give the court the ability to look at all this information and consider or not consider pretty much whatever it wants to?
Madam Chairman, Representative Shetterly, I think as written that's probably true. But what I do think this does is it addresses, I think, a number of judges' concerns, and it gives them, as you pointed out, as Representative Ringo pointed out, there are opinions even now where they have sort of decried their absolute rigidity of having to apply PGE versus Bowley. And there may be some judges out there under this statutory framework who would be willing to retest that application by this change. And I think that may be the best we could possibly hope for. I don't think it does mandate that they, you know, they'll give it appropriate weight.
Senator Ringo.
What do they do in other states? I mean, they've got this problem all over the country.
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, I confess to not having done a thorough analysis of other states. I think in a lot of respects, the way our judiciary is established in Chapter 174 may be unique to Oregon. I have not looked beyond Oregon on this issue.
Representative Ringo, we have not either. We simply use the statute as a starting point.
Madam Chair.
Representative,
I think it's a good approach, and I like Greg's suggested language too. The concern I've always had with going too far to overrule legislatively the PGE versus Boley approach to statutory construction is the risk that we create this system that might encourage the legislature to not say what it means or to salt the mine, you know, with bits of legislative history that are hidden in the record that aren't apparent on the face of the statute. That to me would be going too far in terms of giving the legislature the ability to control what a statute means by use or manipulation of the legislative history. But in this, giving the court the, going back to that language in sub three, the discretion to weigh the information the court considers appropriate, I think gives the court the ability, if it's looking at legislative history and considers something to be a nefarious insertion of some little nugget by somebody who intended by that to divert the meaning of the statute to something that's not apparent on its face and it doesn't give fair notice, I think it gives the court the ability to disregard that. And I think this, just in terms of laying out a conceptual framework to determine what the statutes mean and what the legislature intended, oops, I'm using those words, what the purpose of the bill was within the text and context, I think this is a good approach. I'll be interested in hearing from Judge Gillette, who I'm sure has signed up to testify on this as well, but I appreciate it.
Ms. Chouteau.
Thank you. With respect to subsection 2, I understand the intent is to only make legislative history only make it an issue when the parties make it an issue. But I would express a concern that by the wording that you've got here, you've got a situation where it seems to me that it's saying that the court has to rely on what the parties provide for you as legislative history. And having been an appellate court clerk, I can tell you that parties vary diversely on how well they do their research and how much they provide you with. So I would just suggest that you might want to clarify that brings it up to the issue, but then the court should be able to have the ability to go to the archives and look at everything in the record.
Thank you. Our intent was not to preclude a court from doing that, but rather to make it clear that the court's obligation was limited by what the parties did. And we are very aware that there are various levels of legislative history, and we purposely tried not to get into any specificity on how deep a court needed to go and left that rather to the parties. But it may be that some clarifying language would be appropriate.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, I guess if a court ever looks at the legislative history on this bill, and follow this. No, I think it's pretty clear. It says the court is required to consider only if it's brought forward by the parties. I don't think that precludes the court from making its own examination.
Madam Chair, I'll just, if I could, put one more point on the record. I think as hard as we try through the process we've got currently to create some form of legislative history, I'm the first to suggest that we don't do a very good job in this process. We do a better job than I think was being done 10 or 20 years ago with respect to legislative history, but we still don't do a very good job, and it would be my hope that at some point we would create a more uniform manner for collecting, maintaining, and archiving appropriate legislative history in this building, moving from staff measure summaries to perhaps committee reports that actually reflect, you know, some adoption of intent formally in a committee report or some other approaches as Congress uses to create legislative history, I think is a direction that, frankly, over time we're likely going to need to go. And that's going to take resources. But I think that's an issue that the legislature has always shorted itself on and occasionally pays the price because of their inability to develop and maintain accurate legislative history.
Representative Lohmann. Thanks. I like this bill. The subsection 4 kind of gives me pause. It only allows the court to use canons of construction after it's gone through the other steps outlined in Section 1, as amended by Mr. Mao. I guess I'm a little worried about restricting judicial discretion in that area. What's your thinking on that?
Madam Chairman, Representative Lowe, as I said, I don't have any pride of authorship in this. My belief now is that canons of construction currently fall after the text and context analysis. So I'm not sure this is necessarily, even under PG versus Boley, a reordering of the approach. Justice Gillette may have a better response for you on that than I.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Justice Gillette?
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Michael Gillette. I'm an associate justice in the Oregon Supreme Court. But I want to make it clear for the record, I'm not appearing here on behalf of the Supreme Court. All the other members of the court are aware that I'm here. I'm not sure all of them are sanguine about that, but at all events, I am not here with marching orders. I am merely here to offer whatever insight I may be able to offer with respect to the conundrum faced by the body. Let me say in terms of background that I can make at least one claim, and that is that I am the longest-serving appellate judge in Oregon right now. I'm finishing my 24th year at it. And so I have construed a lot of statutes, and there are doubtless people, if not in this room, at least people who've served in this building who would say that I have misconstrued a lot of statutes. But I want to assure you, I probably don't need to, but I'm going to anyway, I want to assure you that there has never been a construction that I have been involved in, either because I wrote it or because I concurred in it, in which there was any effort to do anything other than identify the intent of the legislature. We in the judiciary do not think that it is our task to do anything else but to try to identify what your intent is. And in carrying out that function of attempting to interpret the intent of the legislature, we have used various paradigms, the most recent of which is established by the decision in PGE versus Boley. But I should make it clear to you that that decision, which was authored by my former colleague, Justice Van Humisen, that decision simply reiterated what the court had been saying for at least 10 years before that. In fact, In working on a completely different problem the other day, I was reading an opinion I wrote soon after I joined the Supreme Court in 1986 and found virtually the same words as the PGE paradigm, in my opinion, explaining how we were construing a statute. And that was 10 years before PGE. So the practice had been around for a while. The difficulty, as I understand it from the statement of Representative Williams, the difficulty is perceived by a good many, at least, is that while the words of a statute may be completely unambiguous as one reads the statute, and may remain so even when one considers the relevant statutory and constitutional context, but nonetheless, if one were to look at the legislative history, one would discover that the words, in fact, were intended to deal with a slightly different problem and therefore were intended to be used in an unconventional or less predictable way than one would have grasped from looking at the face of the statute alone. To put it differently, ambiguity exists either because the words themselves in their interaction do not paint a clear picture, or because the words themselves, when understood in the context of the legislative enactment process, don't paint a clear picture. And it's the latter proposition that is the basis for both of the proposals that you have before you. I have only had just a brief opportunity to look at the material that Greg Mao has offered to you. It is, I will tell you candidly, it seems to me a vast improvement over the bill as proposed, because the bill as proposed contains within it a couple of things you can't possibly mean, or you shouldn't mean. You really shouldn't mean, the best example of which is to suggest that in considering the meaning of meaning and purpose of a measure, the court can look to public statements about the purpose or meaning of the statute that were made before the enactment of the statute. By whom? Where? Under what circumstances? With what authority? That's just foolishness, to be blunt about it. Anybody, an opponent of the measure? It doesn't say, just that's a bad idea. And the Barr's version eliminates that. Good for them. Barr's version also eliminates the use of the word language when you mean wording, which is a personal fetish of mine. The language of all the measures that I read are in English. The wording, however, is what matters. So I congratulate the Barr for eliminating both of those things, which make me grumpy. With respect to the rest of it, I'd just like to share with you for a minute the thought process that I understand to be involved behind this proposal, and then the thought process that a judge goes through in trying to construe a statute. In the law, we have a concept of ambiguity in contracts, for example, that admits that a contract may be patently ambiguous or latently ambiguous. That is to say, the words may not seem ambiguous all by themselves, but when you understand the context in which the contract was made, the words become ambiguous, and courts recognize both forms of ambiguity. I understand from Representative Williams' comments that he is asking for nothing more than that the courts, in construing statutes, allow for the same possibility. And I think, okay, fine. In fact, I can tell you that, I think I'm breaking the secrets of the confessional, but I'll go ahead and do it. The day that PGE versus Boley was decided, and the seven of us were sitting around voting yay and nay, the presence of the paradigm in the decision was not considered particularly important. We were trying to decide a case, and we simply were laying out in some more detail than we commonly did the way in which we were dealing with the statute that was dispositive of the case. But even that day, and for several cases thereafter when we first began to cite PGE, two members of the court argued that legislative history was something that we ought to look at the, quote, first level, close quote, of analysis. And the majority of us thought not, because the majority of us felt that it was not permissible for legislative history to overrule words that were absolutely clear. All we required was that, however, was the words be absolutely clear. If there was some ambiguity, we'd go look at legislative history. But what I want to tell you is that the argument over whether what went on in these rooms is pertinent at the first or second level of analysis is an argument that went on at the time we were putting together the paradigm and has continued. There continues to be at least one member of my court who would look at legislative history anyway, and who in fact cheerfully acknowledges when he writes an opinion that he peaked, that he went ahead and looked anyway just to be sure, although he thought that the wording was unambiguous, just to be sure that he had it right. And there's been at least one case in which he wrote an opinion in which he said, you know, when you look at the legislative history, I'm not sure they intended this at all. But the words don't admit of more than one rational explanation, and therefore this is what we have to do. And so that's what we've been doing. And if you want us to do it differently, then fine. Tell us to, and we'll do it. Representative Shetterly says there may be a constitutional problem, and I understand that the appellate division of the bar is going to offer you a similar suggestion. I wouldn't presume to offer an answer to a constitutional question based upon no argument. I have a hard enough time when it's been clearly argued. But I do want to point out to you that suggesting to us the way in which we ought to deal with your work product probably is something you get to do. And if you wanted to tell us to use Samuel Johnson's dictionary, for example, I suppose that's what we do, because that would be part of the wording, the meaning of the wording that you intended to include. So we will listen prayerfully to whatever you tell us to do, We will not regard it as an insult if you appear to be trying to overrule legislatively a paradigmatic decision that we made, which we thought would be useful in explaining how we think about these problems. But if you're going to give us the instruction, I ask you to think about what it is you're telling us, and at least don't be ambiguous about that. And in that regard, let me use an example which is close to the example that Representative Williams used. Suppose a statute passed by this body, approved by at least 16 members of the Senate and 31 members of the House and signed by the governor, a statute that refers to red widgets. And a case comes to us in which a party is asserting that the statute, although it speaks to red widgets, includes blue widgets. Now, I would submit that there, when the word red is used, there is no room to include blue. Or we can make it even easier. It says two widgets, and the claim is it includes four. But at all events, a word that isn't subject to much analysis. However, the party then offers legislative history which shows that in committee, Representative Shetterly said, I realize that we're going to just leave red in because it's late in the session and we're busy, but in fact, this will include blue, white, and green widgets, so that there is information provided at least to a committee to the effect that the scope of the bill is larger than or is greater than the words would suggest. What are we supposed to do with that? Right now, the proposed bill says that we can give it such weight as we find that it's worth, but that's no help, because what we're faced with is a situation in which the words mean one thing and the expression, an authoritative expression of intent, means something else. And consider the number of parameters that are available with respect to that kind of information. Does red mean blue if one representative said so in a letter to a committee? Does it mean blue if the representative was a member of the committee and said so, or was testifying before the committee and said so? Does it mean blue if in fact the carrier of the bill on the floor informed the entire body that that's what it meant? What weight do we give it? What kind of help are you giving us when you tell us look at it, but then you don't tell us anything about how to make use of it? Our problem, you see, is that we don't know who heard, much less who agreed, with respect to anything other than the words that you passed, because it's only the words that you passed that got the votes. And so we have tried, consistent with what we would think you would want us to do, to respect the words that you all voted on. And we know even there that with respect to all but the simplest measures, there may be more than one intent involved. There may be shared intent on the part of some and a contrary intent on the part of others, all of whom have the same faith with respect to the words that are being used. And so what you hand to us is a license to not to do mischief, because we don't intend to, but a license perhaps accidentally to do it, because you've handed us ammunition and then expect us to find a gun to fit it in. What I want you to think about, what I ask you to think about, even saying I want you to think about overstates that this is your house, not mine, what I ask you to think about is, what is it you really expect us to do? When we go to legislative history, we do so recognizing that every piece of information we get is less authoritative by definition than the vote and the words that you passed, because none of the rest of it was voted on. None of the rest of it was actually agreed to by a constitutional majority. And so you're always asking us to use that which is less helpful, and we only go to that which is less helpful when we can't get an answer out of the words themselves. If we're wrong to do that, then tell us to do something else, and we will do it. But be sure you really think we're wrong to do it.
Madam Chair?
Ms. Shirley.
Thanks. Red widget analogy, red widget, blue widget, doesn't this bill just say that once you have been invited to examine the legislative history and you have seen this discussion of green and white widgets, you give weight to that? But then we also get to sub 4. I mean, aren't there canons of construction that guide your consideration of those various elements of the legislative history? All this says is look at it. It doesn't tell you what to do with it. And I don't think we could as a matter of public policy, I don't think we would want to try to bind the court's hands so tightly in that respect. But doesn't this just say at least look at it and then apply your judicial judgment, discretion, and the canons of construction after you've seen the totality of the record, if you've been invited to examine into it?
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, answer the questions, yes. Long question, short answer, yes. If I can elaborate, however, a question was, if I may, Madam Chair, the question was raised earlier, I believe, by Representative Lowe with respect to the sweep and the scope of subsection 4, and I'm now looking at the bar's proposal, and I'm assuming that for the purposes of this discussion, we're probably talking about that, because I understood Representative Williams to indicate he felt probably it was a better, cleaner, slightly tighter version of what he intended. What I was trying to remember was if we have any maxims of statutory construction which purport to affect the what we now call the first and second levels, wording and then legislative history. The one that came to mind was the maxim of statutory construction that where there are two possible meanings to the words, the legislature intended that which is constitutional rather than that which is not. The trouble I've always had with that is the legislature intended to do whatever it intended to do, and if the Constitution says no, it's only later you're even supposed to ask that question. So I've never found that maxim to be of much help. I assume sometimes the legislature intends to test the Constitution. It ought to, you know, just see how much play there is in the joints. And so I've never liked the maxim much, but it was the one that came to mind, and I'm probably forgetting more useful ones. I don't know how they play in before the last level anyway, and so I guess I'm not much concerned with the suggestion that we leave them until then. PGE versus Boley says we will leave them until then. I think the difficulty with it is, even in writing PGE versus Boley, we were carrying out some maxims of statutory construction we weren't acknowledging at the first and second levels. So I don't know that this handcuffs us at all. I hope it doesn't. I don't think it's intended to talk about intent. I'm not sure I answered your question, Representative Shetterly.
There was a conversation, not a specific question in need of a specific answer. Of course, I guess there's nothing in this that precludes the court from creating a new canon of construction to deal with anything that this bill might raise. And I let me ask this, though. Do you see this as effectively overruling PGE versus Boley, or does... Is there room for interplay between them?
Oh, as I understand both the conversation that occurred here today and as I read the words both of the bill and of the bar's alternative, this changes PGE and Boley. There isn't anything to overrule in the sense that obviously in a given case all of those things are going to be looked to by any court carrying out its own responsibilities. So I don't know that there's a case to overrule in that sense, but it changes the paradigm. I don't think there's any room to question that because it folds into one level what presently is considered to be two different levels of analysis.
Manager.
Representative Shetterly.
Changes the paradigm, but will it likely change the result?
Rarely. Rarely, if at all. And can I explain that just
yes,
slightly,
sir.
Madam Chair? Here's the charm of this, using the patent and latent ambiguity idea. Let's suppose, again, that the words of the statute are clear and unambiguous. And it's only by going to the legislative history that an ambiguity pops up. If the ambiguity is created by the legislative history, how likely is it that the legislative history also will resolve it? If you follow the irony of this line of inquiry, it's only ambiguous if you look to the legislative history. Well, if the legislative history creates the ambiguity, it's liable not to solve it. It may. But it's liable not to. And so there's this kind of, this creature is devouring itself pretty soon. But let's assume that it not only demonstrates that there is an ambiguity, but then it solves the ambiguity. Well, we're fine. The case turns out the way the case turns out. And in that rare circumstance, I suppose the outcome might be different. That's the only circumstance in which the outcome will be different. And I would submit that in statutory construction cases heard by the Court of Appeals in my court, that will happen once a year. No more than that. It just is not going to occur very often.
I have one more.
Yes, you may.
Just so much fun. Well, I guess a case in point, let's say a statute relating to overtime compensation for certain state employees.
I love these hypotheticals.
Failed to specifically address a certain class of employees if the legislative history is replete with references and a clear indication as to what the legislature intended. Could you get there under this construct?
Under PG and Boley, no.
Under this
statute,
yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. Assuming that the purely hypothetical offered by Representative Shetterly includes a legislative history replete with the information he describes, I have no idea what kind of a case that would be.
That would have saved us a few million dollars.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thanks,
Representative Ringo.
Thanks for coming, Justice Gillette. Are you familiar with this primordial scream opinion?
I think I know who uttered the scream. My sympathy for the screamer is under control. Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, I'm sorry I'm not following the procedure. I apologize to you. Again, I'm in your house and I ought to pay more attention.
It's working. There are
people who do not like the constraints that are created by PGE versus Boley. As I indicated, members of my own court were not altogether satisfied with it. And it's perfectly reasonable, it seems to me, for a person to say there is another paradigm that we could use instead, which might on occasion get us more fully into the legislative intent and give us a more satisfactory answer. Whether complaining about that constitutes either a primordial or a primal scream, and I'm never quite sure which kind of scream it's supposed to be.
Plus primal.
Whether that constitutes a scream or not, this does not strike me to be the sort of thing people ought to scream about. But yes, there are a number of members of the Court of Appeals who feel, I think it's fair to say, feel hemmed in by PGE versus Boley, and probably would be happier with this, with the choice that's represented by the proposal that's before you. Please, Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, don't misunderstand here. I make no extra money by defending PGE versus Boley. What I need to defend, however, is a process, an intellectual process, by which we try to divine what it is this body was up to. And that's all we're ever trying to figure out. If, in your view, that exercise would be better served by doing what you propose to do, as it is proposed that you do here, then do it. But just be sure that you really think that's what it would accomplish. With a full appreciation, or at least as full as my poor words will give to you, a full appreciation of what it is we're trying to do and the way we try to do it.
Thank you very much, Justice Gillette. Appreciate you being here.
Chair Walker, I want to thank the committee for its courtesies. A number of people come to me, and this happens other times, so I'll offer one thanks now for every time I appear here. Very concerned about my time. Again, this is your house, and you're doing your work. It's a privilege to be allowed to appear here and take some part in it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Philip Schradel.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, I hardly ever get to Philip Schradel, special counsel to the Attorney General, for the record. I hardly ever get the privilege of following Chief Justice or Associate Justice Gillette. Usually I make comments and then he asks hard questions of me. But hopefully I can maybe provide some helpful information to the members of the committee from our perspective about the proposal. And the concerns that I have are a couple of practical concerns. As I understand the proposal, and I think that the bar's amendments to the proposal would call for consideration to be given to legislative history in virtually all cases. And there's a practical component to that that is of concern. I think the committee and the legislature needs to be aware that, you know, that undertaking to engage in the research about legislative history is not easy. Sometimes it's time-consuming and expensive. And it does add a component of complexity and difficulty to all cases. And so my suggestion, in part, would be to give serious consideration to having some kind of a trigger that you would use to go to legislative history, so that it wouldn't go in every case. And that's one of the primary concerns we have about the proposal right now, that it would call for engaging in that kind of legislative history research and discussion in all cases. And now, contrary to that, I mean, the current paradigm that Justice Gillette was talking about under PGE versus Foley would mean that you would virtually never go to legislative history. And I think there might be some constructive conversation, and I was very pleased to hear Representative Williams say that he, you know, views this as a conversation, because I think this is a good conversation for us to have, because the current paradigm under PGE versus Boley would allow a circumstance, and I'll kind of segue into Representative Ringo's question. It was in Young versus State that Judge Hazelton on the Court of Appeals was rendering the primal scream about feeling compelled to not be able to take into consideration that from all appearances, it appeared that the legislature simply erred in not addressing in the statutory terms whether certain managers in state government were covered or not covered by the overtime law. And under the paradigm in PG versus Boley, the court felt compelled to not be able to address that because the statute, the terms in the statute were clear. And I think that a healthy and constructive conversation could be engendered around the idea that if the clear terms, even if they are clear, lead to an illogical or an absurd result or some other formulation of the right kind of a trigger for that, that you do look to legislative history to discern the legislature's intent. I have not formulated that in precise terms, but I think that there could be formulations developed that would aid in avoiding a circumstance which I think all parties concerned think that that was, you know, an unfortunate circumstance, that it just simply appeared as if there was a mistake made during the legislative process and a particular area was not covered. You know, a second concern that I expressed in the testimony about the paradigm where you would go into legislative history in all circumstances, I think might also have some unintended consequences, and I think that Representative Shetterly's comments in discussion with Justice Gillette also touched upon that, that there almost might be the unintended consequence that you would encourage people to try and embed somewhere in the bowels of the legislative history ideas solely for the purpose of, you know, unearthing them at some later point to make a point in subsequent litigation. And it's very true that quite often it's a very dynamic process in the legislative process that you have people testifying on both sides of matters and people working out compromise language from very, very different perspectives. And the legislative history may not only be clear on it, but it may well support both versions. And the difficulty, and Justice Gillette was addressing this, is how the court is to discern what was either persuasive to members of the committee or persuasive to members on the floor as you were voting. And I think that's a real concern, so that legislative history shouldn't be seen as a panacea that will solve all problems. Rather, it should be used as a helpful tool only in those circumstances where you need to engage in that kind of an analysis. That's a long-winded way of saying I think that a good approach might be not only to have something like what the Bar's proposal does, which is call upon the court or actually require the court to consider legislative history only when the parties bring it forth, but also give consideration to if the rules of statutory construction and looking at text and context of the words lead to an illogical or absurd result or some other formulation of some kind of a standard for the court to use, that then it would be appropriate also to consider the legislative history. We are not opposed to engaging in this discussion at all or working towards agreed-upon language to amend Chapter 174. Our office has, in fact, attempted to convince the court on a couple of occasions that the current paradigm is too restrictive. We're hopeful that even if no amendments go forward, that nevertheless the court may well perceive that there are circumstances in the current context that would allow the court to get to legislative history. But I think that some help could be there through this proposal, and I think this vehicle might be a very good one to engage in that discussion. And I certainly would offer to the committee that the Department of Justice would be more than willing to work with, you know, whatever constituency you would ask us to see if a formulation of an appropriate standard could not be accomplished.
Thank you, Mr. Schradl. Any questions? Representative Ringo.
Thanks, Mr. Schradl. Do you know how they do it in other states?
Chair Walker, Representative Ringo, no, I am not aware of how they do it in other states. We have pretty much been driven in the case law in Oregon on the paradigm of the statutes in Oregon, and that's the I'm not aware.
Just a follow up. I mean, don't you think they've got exactly the same problem in every state?
Chair Walker, Representative Ringo, I'm certain that they have, if not exactly the same problem, a very similar problem, and I'm sure that courts and legislatures in other states have wrestled with the same issues.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. I don't know, Phil, I would think that getting back to your comments about establishing some sort of a trigger here, we've got ambiguity now, at least the way it's dealt with in the PGE versus Boley approach. You suggested illogical or absurd results. To me, that seems too restrictive, too, because sometimes there may just be good or better results that the court ought to be able to get at. I'd be curious, and I like what Justice Gillette suggested in his analogy to the way courts approach contracts. And I wish we had the digests here. I'd be inclined to see what the just look up a case that says what a court says and how it interprets language in a contract. You know, this issue of latent ambiguity and patent ambiguity, I think that may be instructive. I'd be interested in looking at that. That seems to me to be something that courts are familiar with, litigants are familiar with, and it seems to work in contracts, in the context of contracts. I'd be interested to see how that might apply as a statement of the court's scope of inquiry in a statutory context.
Chair Walker, may I?
Yes, sir.
Add a comment. Representative Shetterly, in response, I think that there might be some benefit to looking to that body of case law and that discussion. I think we should go in with our eyes open that it may be in a slightly different context, because in the contractual matter, quite often you will have potentially parties that are in differing, varied circumstances, so that you have propositions like, you know, the contract will be construed against the drafter and those kinds of things. It just needs to be done in such a way that, you know, you don't import into this discussion principles and things that would not necessarily have bearing in the legislative process.
So, Madam Chair, if David Hendricks were ever in front of the court with this bill, it would be considered against him.
Pick on David. Any other questions for Mr. Schradl? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, David Groom.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Groom. I'm currently director of the State Public Defender's Office. Normally, people from my side, which we prefer to call something like His or Her Majesty's Loyal Opposition, doesn't appear on the civil side, and actually PGE versus Boley caused me a severe personal problem, which is I've always made a vow never to read a civil case. Civil law is mostly boils down to money, whereas criminal law is involving the higher processes of liberty and due process. So I had to read PGE versus Boley because it does apply to criminal cases, and the bill that is proposed here today also apparently applies to criminal cases. So I wanted to appear because there are some practical problems that my office would face, outlined a little bit by Mr. Schradl, which could have a fiscal impact. Dreaded words, I know. The problem that we get is that the legislature or the people in an initiative will pass something and it will have unintended consequences down the line. A good example of that is ballot measure 11, which was passed in 1995. Our office was going along at a fairly even clip, and when that passed, a ton of new cases came in and we didn't have sufficient resources to handle them, and we developed a backlog. I can see a backlog developing as a result of something like this bill, where we take in approximately 2,000 appeals per year and are required to go to the legislative history in order to determine what we should present to the courts as far as our argument goes. The archives building is not too far from our office, and we do go on a regular basis to look at legislative history. The problem is that this bill seems to make legislative history co-equal with the statute itself. And so in order to present our view of the statute, we're going to have to look at legislative history in every case. That will certainly slow us down and will certainly at some point cause us to have to give cases back to the indigent defense system, which will cause them a fiscal impact. One practical problem I thought of while I was sitting there is I've had cases that I've gone to do legislative research on where there will be a bill that's presented in February and heard in one house, then by the time it gets to the other house, it's May or June, and the parties and the people involved in the bill will all have had time to think about it, and the testimony in front of the two subcommittees is entirely different, and the purpose of the bill perhaps changes over the course of time, or some of the wording. When you get to, I guess the practical problem is, do you want to set yourselves up for saying, well, okay, we got this language we've passed for a bill, now should we pass also, should we vote on some legislative history language to send over to the Senate so that the Senate knows why we passed what we did, and so the Senate then votes on that and the language of it, so that everybody's on the same page as far as what the legislative history is. And I think that there's from your point of view, if I may, a kind of a practical problem there. At the present time, intent is basically a clarifier if the language is unambiguous. This I think makes intent co-equal with the statute itself. Finally, I'd offer an anecdote that from my own personal caseload one time. A long, long time ago, I think it was 1979, I had a case that involved a brand new statute at the time, which was criminal mistreatment. I had a client who was accused of criminal mistreatment for neglecting his children. I read the language of the statute. It appeared to be fairly unambiguous. I went and looked at the legislative history, and the criminal mistreatment statute was passed to counter abuses in nursing homes. That was the purpose of the statute. So I went and I told that to the Court of Appeals, and then Chief Judge Schwab looked down at me and said, well, don't we look first at the plain meaning of the statute and only go to legislative history if the language is unclear? And that was the first time I'd ever heard that, and my brain went numb, because basically that's what happened every time I faced Chief Judge Schwab anyway. And I said yes, and I sat down. The interesting point to me is that if this statute had been in place at the time, it's quite possible that the court would have said, correct, this is only to curb nursing home abuses. I've never had a nursing home abuse case. I've had a lot of criminal mistreatment cases, which all involve negligent treatment of children. And so one unintended consequence would be that you might overrule some of your own statutes that have plain meaning but maybe a different legislative intent. That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Questions? Well, thank you very much. Is there anyone else here who wanted to testify on 3677? Ruth Bishop?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the subcommittee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm an attorney with Harang Long, Gary Rudnick in our Salem office. And I've enjoyed the dialogue this morning about House Bill 3677 and just wanted to at least register my interest and concerns with this whole topic. Over the last year, I've had the privilege of appearing before Justice Gillette on ballot titled challenges, arguing against Mr. Schradl on some of those measures, and have been in this building for nearly 30 years working on legislative issues. What I want to do specifically is to ask you to look very carefully at the bar's proposal in Section 1 sub D, which may be the most controversial part of their proposal. And what sub D says is that the court shall consider relevant information about the statute, including records of proceedings. I would ask you what those are. Are those the tape recordings of the floor debate? Are they committee hearing information? Are they testimony that I present to you on behalf of my clients that are entered into the committee records? Is it all of those things? Records of proceedings at which the legislature considered. We don't really have instances in which the legislature itself as an institution is ever considering a measure. The chambers, the House and the Senate individually consider measures and both vote on the same measures, but all of the information is not presented at the same time. At which the legislature considered the enactment, but not necessarily adopted the enactment, or adopted the statute. And then it says, or information in the voter's pamphlet. And I think, as all of us know, that is one of the most cost-effective ways of communicating about a measure is to buy a $500 statement in the voter's pamphlet. And that will certainly be something that we will use as advocates for our clients to establish a legislative record in the voter's pamphlet. But the section then says, in the voter's pamphlet about the measure that adopted the statute. And I don't know what that means. As Justice Gillette suggested to you, I would urge you to be careful in this kind of language to make sure that you're providing clear direction not only to the court, but to others of us who are engaged in this process. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, with regard to the voter's pamphlet, maybe we could just provide an exclusion that the court would not consider matter that appears in bold print, capital letters, or underline.
Or italicized.
Since it's inherently unreliable.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Bishop. Okay. Okay, I'm going to close the hearing. Representative Williams left. I'm going to reschedule this one a later time because obviously there needs to be some work done on that. So I think a week would be sufficient. Maybe we can get it back on the schedule at that time. I'm going to close the hearing on 3677. I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2381. Any discussion?
What is it?
23. We had this hearing, I don't know the date.
Madam Chair, if I might, House Bill 2381 was first heard on February 12th. It comes from the Oregon Collectors Association, and it deals with attorney's fees in contract actions for claims less than $5,500. You have in your packets -2 amendments that come from the proponents that were worked on after the concerns were expressed in the hearing. You also have -3 amendments that come from, I believe, a constituent of Representative Zahner, and I believe you have, I don't know if it was put in your packets or needs to be passed out, 2 letters in support of the -3 amendments.
Discussion.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I would appreciate hearing from Jim Markey on this. I've not had a chance to get through the dash twos.
Okay. Mr. Markey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. Jim Markey on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. When we had the hearing on this bill, there were some concerns raised, and I've worked diligently with all parties involved to reach a compromise which would not be opposed by any of the parties, and we're there. This original bill amended ORS 20.080, which offers the present law under 20.080 offers to refresh your memory, offers attorney fees to a prevailing plaintiff in an action for injury or wrong to a person or property where the amount prayed for is under $5,500. That statute is used in a lot of tort cases. It has also been used successfully in many contract cases in some jurisdictions. Different jurisdictions deal with this issue differently on contract cases. The original bill amended 20.080 to provide that it would apply to contract cases so that all jurisdictions would treat it equally. There were several people had concerns about that. The new approach taken has been to actually adopt an amendment offered by Representative Ringo first to prohibit the use of 20.080 in contract cases so that it would be limited to tort cases, and then to create a new section of law which presumably would follow 20.080, which would say in a contract case where the contract is silent as to attorney fees, where there is no attorney fee provision in the contract, either party, plaintiff or defendant, who prevails, would be allowed attorney fees if the action were under $5,500. We require the same 10-day demand notice that is required in 20.080, and we say that this statute would apply to contracts where there, again, is no attorney fee provision, but further, that the provisions of the section do not apply to contracts for insurance because generally those are handled under ORS 743 and other statutes. Contracts for which another statute authorizes or requires the award of attorney fees, which was a recommendation of Representative Shetterly's, I believe. Any action for damages for breach of an express or implied warranty because those are covered under 20.098. And any action against the maker of a dishonored check under ORS 30.701. So with these amendments, we think that we've clarified when attorney fees would be awarded in these cases. We would no longer have attorneys using 20.080 for contract cases. We think it's a better approach. The Oregon State Bar is neutral now. They were opposed because of concerns regarding 20.080. And I dealt with three different sections of the Oregon State Bar, and I think they're all neutral.
Can I?
Yes.
Which section?
Representative Lowe.
Thanks. So Robert Neuberger and Greg Mack are okay with this?
I've spoke with directly with Greg Mao. Who said he that I had satisfied his concerns, I believe, was and he's fine. I did not speak directly with Bob Neuberger, but did speak with the lobbyist for the Trial Lawyers Association, who was in contact with Mr. Neuberger, and who assured me Mr. Neuberger was fine and that the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association were fine. And I've also spoke with David Niebel from Legal Aid, and Legal Aid is now neutral on the bill.
Okay. Could I ask a couple of questions? This does or does not include checks?
No.
Checks are excluded?
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, no. Checks are handled under ORS 30.701, and we specifically excluded those cases.
And what about oral contracts?
oral contracts are included.
That makes me nervous.
Well, I think. Express or implied contracts are instruments or documents evidencing a debt, yes. The issue here has been, I think, in my view, the reason I think this is an improvement, more and more lawyers are using 2080 on contract cases. And I always am amazed at the innovations of good lawyers. And many jurisdictions are now allowing attorney fees under 2080. And I think that brings a couple of problems with respect to policy on contract cases. It seems to me that in tort cases, there is a good public policy reason for allowing attorney fees only to the plaintiff. You know, that's historically been the case. But probably that same policy shouldn't apply to contracts, and they ought to be reciprocal. And so we just think this is a better way to handle a situation that's people are using now. So.
Thank you. One more question, Jim. I think my notes indicate that Robert Neuberger raised one important public policy question that I wrote down anyway, and that was why allow additional attorney's fees where a debtor simply allows a judgment to be taken, because 90% of those go by default anyway. So in your dialogue and conversations with them and the fix that you proposed to this, does that take care of that issue?
Well, the court would be allowed to grant attorney fees on default cases. It's always subject to reasonable attorney fee rule. So a judge could allow less attorney fees on a default than he might if it went to trial.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, even in a default case, though, the plaintiff has had to incur the expense of retaining legal counsel. And when you're talking about a contract in the amount that we're dealing with in the dash twos, why, you know, that you don't have a lot of extra room there to absorb those. So, in fairness to plaintiff, I think this is a good step. I would be uncomfortable with the dash threes. Since we're just moving in this direction, I'd sooner stick our big toe in the water than jump in a little farther as the dash threes would invite us to do with raising the amount. But,
Madam Chair, if I might, I am here to support the dash twos. I would. I have worked very, very diligently to get all parties okay on this. All parties would not be okay if the dash threes were adopted. I think we would see World War III begin between the trial lawyers and the insurance industry. And I mean, this is you're looking at a guy that used to represent the trial lawyers, so I understand how all those issues and how emotional those issues are. I would ask, if you did choose to adopt the dash threes, I would have to ask you not to move the bill forward. I would oppose my own bill if you adopted the dash threes.
Seeing as Alana is sitting in the back row, shaking her head.
Representative Engel, thank you.
I'm a little bit uncomfortable with this in that, I just saw these amendments this morning and contemplating the impact. And I guess I would have liked the opportunity to see them ahead of time so I could discuss them with David Niebel or the trial lawyers. The way I see it, there's several different contexts that need to be considered. One of the contexts, I think, is where you're coming from, and that is the collection business and how this will facilitate collection attorneys such as Jeff Hansen, who testified here, and what financial impact this will make to him or to the collection business in general. There was some testimony from Attorney Hassan that I think he files an average of 80 lawsuits a month, 8,300, something like that. And I think the obvious conclusion is that the legal assistant does 99% of the work and that they're essentially just turned out. And then you can argue, well, is it really in the public interest to allow attorney fees in that situation where somebody's already received collection notices, whether they can't pay, they won't pay, there's a good faith dispute, they don't have the money, they're 30 days from bankruptcy anyway, whether it's a good public policy stance to allow attorney fees, you can argue that. There's the other context of this applies to any contractual dispute, such as somebody who takes a car to an auto mechanic. You know, and there's a...
I'm sorry, such
they as... They take a car to an auto mechanic, and there's a dispute as to whether the muffler was really fixed right or not. And I think this is a huge expansion, because it doesn't just apply to collection issues, which is your interest, but it applies to any contract under 5500, and then except some exceptions, but it is a huge expansion. And if we talk about the auto mechanic for a minute, I think then you have to consider whether it's a good public policy to allow attorney fees for those kinds of disputes. I haven't had a chance to look at this to see how this fits in with small claims, for example. I think those kinds of disputes are best handled in small claims, but I wouldn't want to see some lawyer say, no, don't do this in small claims, because I can make money by suing the auto mechanic, or I can make money by suing the guy who brought in the car and thinks there's a dispute. And I think that context needs to be examined very carefully, and maybe you could speak to that.
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, there were a lot of comments in there, and let me try to respond to what you're saying.
Okay.
I'm very familiar with 20080 and its use throughout the legal industry. All of the arguments that you make regarding contracts could be made about 20080 with respect to torts. On a small tort, there are people in this room who would argue those ought to be handled in small claims, and that's their point of view.
Just to keep the conversation going, I think the point of 20080 is it represents, it recognizes a power disparity. I mean, there are all kinds of situations where it applies, but the chief situation is in auto accidents, where you've got somebody who's got a dinged fender and you've got an insurance company that's got their heels dug in.
But you
or that kind of. I'm just saying that, and that's why it's one way. That's why 20080 is one way, because it recognizes a power disparity. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, yes, I understand that, and I understand the legislative history and have been involved in that over the years.
I know you have.
But your example of a muffler shop, I believe that case could be brought under 20080, under present law. And so you're arguing against a public policy that already exists.
Well, as just follow up, Madam Chair, as we both know, different jurisdictions are coming down differently on whether 20080 applies to a contract or not. And in that regard, perhaps there does need to be a decision. I would agree with you that we probably do need consistency. I'm just wondering whether this is the best way to go on that.
And Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, I completely respect your opinion about that, and I represent clients who have an opinion about how this ought to be done, and we have brought that to you. That's why we have a legislative assembly, to make those kinds of policy decisions. And
thank you very much, Mr. Marquis. Appreciate you coming forward.
Yes.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Lowe.
I appreciate that. I've done a lot of collection practice law in my lifetime, and I think that this is an improvement. And I'm not comfortable with the dash threes, but I think the dash twos are great and fair, and everybody's going to be happy with that. So,
thank you.
I just want to put that on the record.
Okay, thank you. Okay, clerk, call the roll, please. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't have the motion. I'll entertain a motion on the dash three.
Madam Chair.
Excuse me, the dash two.
I move the dash two amendments to 2381.
Thank you. Any discussion on the dash two? No discussion. The dash twos are, excuse me?
Just hang on one.
We're just on the dash two.
Whether to adopt them?
Whether to adopt the dash two.
I'm opposed to adopting them.
Okay. Roll call, please, on dash two.
Representative Backman?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Rizzo?
No.
Representative Shadowin?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. The dash twos are adopted to the 2381 House bill.
Madam Chair, I move 2381 to the full with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Being none, roll call, please.
Representative Backman?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Rizzo?
No.
Representative Shadowin?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. House Bill 2381, as amended with the dash two amendments, is moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Anyone like to be a carrier on this bill?
I'd be happy to be the carrier.
Okay, Representative Lowe will be the carrier.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm on the collection.
Okay. House Bill 2739, I'm going to open the work session. Discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move adoption of the, did we do the dash one amendment?
No, we have not done the dash one amendment. Let me ask Representative Shadowin.
I'm sorry, what?
Representative Shadowin, do you have any comment on the dash one amendments to House Bill 2739?
2739, just that I looked at them, and they did appear to address the concerns that I had in the bill, and I'll just mention those for a couple things. One, we've added on lines 3 and 4 that the trust, 3 through 6, the trust can provide for individually named animals or for a class, but any animal provided for must be living at the time of the trust or his death, so we don't have trust in perpetuity for pets and their progeny. And I think we did add language on 14 and 15 that provides for reasonable compensation out of the trust if the court appoints somebody to be the enforcer. And then I think we added in sub 6 on page 2, acknowledgement that the trust can terminate either when the animal dies or when there's no living animal covered by the trust, or when trust assets are exhausted, or according to the terms of the trust. I think those accommodations, because I suppose you could have somebody who'd want to leave their animal for their dear mother, but as long as their mother's, for as long as mother's alive, but when mother is dead, the animal doesn't serve any more purpose, then maybe the animal goes too. So they can limit the term of the trust within the trust instrument. It's all reasonable. I would move.
Can we
stop the animal? I would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2739.
Question?
Yes.
I noticed that it's a life and being. So we have an actual pet rule against perpetuities.
Well, I guess we do that in some respect, yeah.
Well, okay.
Life and being plus 21 dog years.
21 dog years or cat years?
21 dog years, that's 3 years.
And I dare you to explain that on the floor.
Madam Chair, we do have the...
we're going to have a delightful time on the floor with this
one.
We probably need to bring McKenna in. She's not here to vote today, but she testified the other day.
We do have the Humane Society folks here, maybe at least a thumbs up, so we're not missing anything. Okay, thumbs up.
Okay.
Thank you for the record.
All right.
I think I've made my motion.
Okay, you've had a motion on the dash one amendments. Any further discussion on the dash one? Anyone oppose? Okay, the dash one amendment to 2739 is adopted. Representative Shetterly, would you like to make a motion on this bill?
I would love to move House Bill 2739 as amended to the full committee with a due pause recommendation.
Any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, roll call, please.
Madam Chair.
Oh, yes.
With the due pause recommendation, is that spelled P-A-W-S or P-A-U-S-E? I need to know that.
No, P-A-W-S.
Okay.
Roll call, please.
Aye.
Representative
Shadowin. Aye.
Chair Walker.
Arf. Thank you. Representative Shetterly, would you like to carry this bill?
Me and my cat will be pleased.
You and your cat? Oh. Okay, House Bill 2739, as amended, is passed to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Shetterly will carry that bill.
Can we have this on the floor on the Bring Your Pet to the House Day?
Is there?
Well, there was one last time. Yeah, we had a bring your pet to the house day.
I'm going to let Shadow bring his cat.
Okay, we have a floor session at 10:30, so we have a couple bills here I want to get through. 2460. Open the hearing on 2460. Council, give us a summary, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2460 deals with slap suits, and you'll recall we had lengthy testimony in favor and opposed to this bill. You have in front of you the Dash 2 amendments, which comes from the proponents, Representative Schrader. I haven't heard from Representative Shetterly, so I don't know what his position is.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Shetterly.
I would move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2460, and I'll just make a brief mention of those when you take my motion.
Yes, sir. Discussion, please.
Thank you. I think we heard some testimony. One of the one that I would comment on was the some of the testimony from the Bar Procedure and Practice Committee being concerned about how this overlays on the rules of civil procedure. Frankly, I think that the procedural aspect of this is fairly well dealt with. No, it was well dealt with in the Dash 2 amendments.
No.
And, you know, I guess my feeling about this is we have a record of how this statute has worked outlined in the way that it is in this bill. In California, it is working there. It is well balanced. The record is established that it doesn't favor particularly one side or the other. It just levels the playing field. And this is an important enough area of concern out there in the public. I think we are under some obligation to deal with it. This deals with it well. And, you know, the volume of cases is not going to be so overwhelming here. If there are procedural nuances that we can adjust as the bill rolls out into effect, we can do that in 2 years or 4 years. I think this gets us out of the starting gate finally down the road to addressing the problems that were brought to us by the proponents of this bill. It's a good start. I'd encourage us to give it a good support to the full and then down to the four.
Thank you. Any further discussion on the Dash 2? Being none, anyone opposed to the Dash 2 amendments? Okay. Dash 2 amendments are adopted to House Bill 2460. I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
House Bill 2460 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended?
I'm sorry, as amended. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Being none, roll call, please.
Representative Dodson?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative
Schneider? Aye. Aye. That's what I was just looking at. Representative Shetterly, would you like to be the carrier on this bill?
Sure, I did it last session.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Actually, was this one also brought by
Representative Schrader? Yeah, me. I'll ask Representative Williams when we get to the full to.
Yeah,
we.
I was going to say make that suggestion. The full committee is going to include Representative Schrader.
This has been his baby.
Yeah.
That's right. We'll make it a bipartisan love fest.
Okay, House Bill 2460, as amended, is passed the full committee with a due pass recommendation. And we please ask Mr. Shetterly be a carrier, but at the full committee to please request that Representative Schrader also. Okay, House Bill 2382, Council, give us a summary, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2382 also comes from the Oregon Collectors Association, and it deals with default judgment affidavits. The Dash 3 amendments come from the proponents, and I believe that they address everyone's concerns that were expressed both in the hearing, which was back, I believe, in early February, and also address some concerns that were in the that came from the Dash 2s.
Okay. Mr. Marquis, would you come forward, please? We had an amendment, a Dash 2 amendment, which was a work draft, and we now have a Dash 3. Do the Dash 3 amendments include the proposals in Dash 2?
Madam Chair, Jim Marquis, on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association,
This was our bill, and we were concerned about default judgments on money judgment cases, which is what my clients do, and they don't do a lot of work in some other areas. There is also a piece of this that deals with cases other than money judgments, and Randy Jordan from the Attorney General's office worked directly with David Hendricks to develop the language that was finalized in the Dash 3 amendments. There's a minor difference between the Dash 2s and the Dash 3s that the Attorney General's office felt was important. I apologize that they're not here, but basically it tracks with the language in on money judgments, which now says, the current ORCP says that you have to sign an affidavit to get a default judgment that the defendant is neither incapacitated nor financially incapable as defined under 125.005. The definition of financially incapable gives cause for concern because it is so broad as to include anybody who's disappeared or whatever. And I think that was, everybody agreed with that. The language for both kinds of cases now will say that the plaintiff must submit an affidavit stating to the best of their knowledge and belief that the party seeking the judgment, of the party seeking judgment, that the party against whom the judgment is sought is neither incapacitated as defined in 125.005, is a minor, or is a protected person, or a respondent. That would mean that neither a guardianship nor a conservatorship has been established, nor is there one pending. And all of the parties seem to agree that that was a good thing. One of the sections from the bar had raised the issue that we hadn't been through the Council on Core Procedures, which they were correct, and that was my, I should have done that, and we went back, and I met with Maury Holland, and he got it out to all of the members of the Council on Core Procedures, and they've okayed this, so we're all fine.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Shetterly.
Move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2382.
Thank you. Any discussion of the motion of the Dash 3s? No discussion. Dash 3 amendments to 2382 are hereby adopted. Motion on the bill. Okay. Representative Shetterly. Thank you. Any discussion? Being none, roll call, please.
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. House Bill 2382, as amended, is moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Do I have a carrier?
I'd be happy to carry this one, too.
Representative Lowe will be the carrier. Okay. Those hearings that we conducted today, we will schedule work sessions at our next meeting. And we are hereby adjourned. Out of here. Out of here.